Well, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another Cell's lunchtime seminar. We are extremely grateful to have Professor Ushra Shannon from EUI to give her lunchtime seminar entitled Interpretive Twists, Argumentative Turns and New Reference Points, Unpacking the Jurisprudential Shift in the European Citizenship Jurisprudence. As somebody that, as a researcher interested in EU citizenship law, I take particular interest in this. Professor Shannon is, in addition to a professor law at EUI, she's also an associate professor at the Faculty of Law at the University of Copenhagen, where she previously was an assistant professor. And she also did her PhD there on, and I do love this word, on the European palimpsest, and discovered what that word means for the first time, justificating practices and precedent construction at the Court of Justice of the EU. She also has an LLM from the University of Ljubljana and another one from the College of Europe, and was originally an undergraduate at the University of Ljubljana. Can I give us a wish, a round of applause for her mentor we're looking forward to.
Very much. I appreciate the invitation. I'm really happy to be here. I've never been to Cambridge before, so it's a good opportunity to see Cambridge and to see the faculty. And I will be talking, the title actually says it all, I will be talking about how legal change happens, how change if jurisprudence happens. I will be talking about court-initiated and court-mediated legal change. And it's a subject that I've been thinking about for a really long time, not constantly, but on and off. And here's why. I'll throw in an anecdote. And when I was an LLM student in Bruges, I took this seminar with a very engaging, very exciting title. It was about how and why the jurisprudence of the Court of Justice changes. And after the semester, this is filled with revelations, for the exam, for the oral exam, we had to pick a case which we thought changed European law, in which we thought the court changed the law, reversed its jurisprudence, and we had to explain why. Right, so that was the point, like the studying the motives, no motives of the court, the context, law and context. And then I picked my case, and I was pretty sure I picked a good one, where the court reversed this jurisprudence, reversed this view of the freedom of movement of persons. And I went to the exam, and I was in for an unpleasant surprise, because I was arguing that there was change, and the professor saw no change whatsoever. So I was sent home with a fairly bad grade on that day, and I never got to the question, I never got to explain why. So a decade later, I'm still stuck with the question of how, right? I'm still thinking of how do I prove that there is change, and what do I need to study to see change? Because lawyers usually see change, we know it when we see it. We throw around this concept, jurisprudential reversers, legal change, etc., etc. But we do not problematize this, right? Because this is a part of who we are. We are lawyers, we are trained to detect it, we are trained to study it, we are trained to analyze it. I'm trying to rethink this whole thing a little bit. And in citizenship case law, when scholars a couple of years back, started writing about it, has been a U-turn in European citizenship jurisprudence. There has been a new phase, there has been a new cycle, there has been a new reactionary phase. I was right at it, and I was just like, okay, so what is it? What do I want to say about this? Like, it's like, okay, this is a given, there's a change, and I want to see the process of how this change came about in the court's jurisprudence. So this was my main motivation. And after doing this for a very long time now, so the main thesis, the main argument of the paper is that to unpack the process of jurisprudential change, we should focus on the mechanisms that propel it, on the mechanisms that sustain it. And I study three mechanisms. I study the method of interpretation, the method of teleological interpretation. Then I focus the arguments, the argumentation of the court, especially the argument of the public policy argument of unreasonable burden as a substantive argument. And I study the reference frame, the precedent selection. Right? I say, okay, no change is complete without new precedents replacing the old precedents. So these are the three things. And I find in the paper that there has been transformation in all of those layers of jurisprudence, and then this transformation was not simultaneous, right? But that these mechanisms somehow over time, over a period of 2-3 years, reinforced each other and produced a new type of citizenship jurisprudence, which literatures characterizes as something that is rights closing rather than rights opening. It is not permissive, on the other hand, it is restrictive. It does not favor the individual, but rather balances the individual interest against the public interest. Okay, so we have this change, which is qualitative change, and I'm trying to see how it happened. First, with regard to interpretation, I look at two things. I look at the teleological method of interpretation, and I look at the construction and reconstruction of what we call the autonomous concepts. With regard to teleological method of interpretation, what I see happens, I have many more examples, I'm just going to give you a few examples for you to get a feel of what I'm talking about. What happens is that the court dilutes the main purpose of the citizenship directive into one of the objectives of the directive, right? Before, in the jurisprudence, we would usually find that the main objective of the directive, the ultimate objective of the directive, is to protect individual rights of those people who move within the European Union. Now, over a period of a few years, it starts with Bray, we get this delusion when the court starts invoking recital 10, there is the unreasonable burden, right? Like when the court starts invoking, okay, but one of the aims is also to secure some certain balance between the individual and the public interest. And then in Dano, this culminates into a different kind of balancing when we are already disqualifying the whole group of people, not on their personal circumstances, but because as a group, we have to balance these several objectives. The second one, in Bray, for example, the balancing of these different objectives does not lead to a negative outcome for the individual, right? So we're not yet there. We're just having the balancing exercise, teleological method of interpretation, same method used to achieve a slightly different balance of objectives, and in Dano, same method to achieve a different balance than before. Right? So there's no change. The court still uses the teleological method of interpretation, but it somehow started crowding the objectives, balancing the objectives, diluting the main objective into one of the objectives, and then like the result is a different balance that is being struck. The second one is the autonomous concepts. And if we look at the theory of autonomous concepts, international courts, and that goes back to the study of the Court of Human Rights, the Strasbourg Court, creates autonomous concepts according to the theory. Letzos has been most sort of eloquently putting this out, is to protect rights, right? We have autonomous concepts. Why do we have autonomous concepts? Because we want the member states to not to escape their treaty obligations. We want to protect individual rights. That's why we create them. So like more than 50 years ago, the court in Ungar-Hoekstra says the concept of a worker is a European Union concept in order to secure a certain status for the person who moved within the Union. Now, 50 years later, and again, I'm coming back to Bray and Ziokowski and Seya, which I consider the hinge cases where everything starts changing. In Bray, the court has to define the concept of social assistance, right? Usually, the court would define the concept of a worker broadly, right? However, the court now also defines the social assistance broadly, and that means that the applicant someone loses the right to social assistance, right? Because if we define the social assistance broadly, we are narrowing the concept of social security. And the court says the social assistance, and the advocate general says it as well, is an autonomous concept which secures coordination of our systems, right? So this is the second thing about autonomous concepts. It's not about coordination, it's about rights protection, right? We do not have this because we need to coordinate. We have autonomous concepts to protect rights, not anymore. And in Ziolkowski and Sayer, the court says, well, lawful residence is such an autonomous concept, right? However, the construction of the autonomous concept as autonomous concept goes against the individual and produces a negative result already at this point for the European citizen. Namely, the applicants in the case were lawfully resident in Germany. One of the applicants was lawfully resident in Germany under German law for almost 20 years. However, because they were not lawfully resident under the terms of the Citizenship Directive, they did not qualify for permanent residence in the court's case. Right? Had the court not created the autonomous concept, the applicants would have qualified for permanent residence. However, the court did create this concept and the applicants did not qualify for permanent residence. Now, the Advocate General, and this is, I think, very interesting, did not consider the idea of lawful residence being an autonomous concept. He relied on Martinez Sala, right? She's there, give her the rights, treat her equally, right? So we lose this idea of equal treatment. The Advocate General did proceed from the idea of equal treatment and protection of individual rights. The court reversed this logic already in Ziolkowski and Sayer. Now, with regard to, I'm coming to the second layer now, and the second layer is the layer of reference points or precedents. And I understand these reference points, these precedents, as a framework, as an argumentative framework, as a framework within which the parties can make certain claims, in which also the court will make certain claims. So when we decide new cases, we establish new reference points. And I'm studying, or we're looking at, how does the court relate to citizenship classics in its new case law? What does it consider as settled case law? And we discover, we is not the royal we, but me and my co-author. So just to be clear, okay, because I was... I just caught myself saying we a few times, and I was wondering whether you were wondering... So there's like three different types of dealing with its previous case law, which is very intriguing, I find. And then, for example, references to Grzelczyk and Bambast first serve as this opening line references, right? For example, in Dano, you have this introduction into the argumentative part, and the court says, well, citizenship is the fundamental status, right? But this concept or construct does not do any real work in the argumentation, because in the argumentation, what does work is Bray and Ziolkowski and Sayer, right? So like every argument against the applicant is supported with two other cases, and they are immediately elevated to the settled case law, right? So a very short time passes before these cases become settled case law. Now, the second one is the reinterpretation of classics, and this happens, for example, in the Commission v. UK, where the court says, well, we know that the protection of public finances has always been one of the very legitimate aims of the free movement, of the member states. They want to restrict free movement. And the court has already said that in Bidar and in Grzelczyk, right? That is true, the court has said this. However, citing Bidar and Grzelczyk together with rights-restricting jurisprudence like Bray, Ziolkowski, and Sayer, and Dano especially gives you the idea that the old cases are reinterpreted more restrictively with being cited with new cases. Now, the third and final one is the replacement of the classics, where we do not have any reference to the old fundamental or foundational case law, as we call it, is there, and it's Garcia Nieto, right, where the court interpreting the same law, the same paragraph of the German law of the social security and social assistance, which it interpreted in Matsuras as social security, in Alimano, which it interprets as social assistance, right? The court says it is a case-by-case basis, and it does not refer to Matsuras, lets the advocate general do the work and refers to Alimanovich. Okay, so we have like a complete replacement on the same factual legal situation, domestic situation, however not citing the rights opening but the rights closing cases. With regard to the third layer, coming to the third layer, which is the layer of the argumentation of the slippery slope argument, like in Britain, I think this famous one, the camel's nose is in the tent, right? That everybody knows, you know, like if we do this, then all of a sudden, you know, the premise is we do not want the camel in the tent. So the public policy argument, a substantive argument, so let's say when you want to change the case law, when you want to change the law, you refer to some sort of a substantive argument, an argument of public policy. Look at the consequences of this, right? And this is perfectly legitimate. However, what has happened in the very recent case law, and especially the Advocate General Vatilis' opinions are worrying in this respect, right? What he says is basically, he adopts this axiom of burden, right? In Alimanovich it says, well, the national court doesn't say that the applicant will be unreasonable, an unreasonable burden, but we all know that people like Alimanovich are an unreasonable burden, right? If we let them in, we are going to have very soon, and I'm quoting, en masse relocation from affluent parts of the Union from less affluent parts of the Union into the affluent parts of the Union, right? And why is this an unsustainable argument? And in theory, if you go back into the theory of what is a public policy argument, what is a slippery slope argument, you see that you cannot taint a rational argument with irrational fear. So if you want to support, if you want to make the argument of unreasonable burden a public policy argument, that is absolutely true. You have to put empirical arguments under it. You have to support it with data. Now, I'll give you an example of a good use of that. Like Advocate General Jacobs in Commission v. Austria was invoking the data from the OECD, right? Like, so OECD data on how many students migrate, how much does that cost, etc., etc., how many places at universities does that take? Advocate General Vatilis did have a very similar European Eurostat report on migration in 2014 when he was writing his opinion. The data was back until the end of 2013. He does not refer to it, right? That is an obvious source of reference if you would like to support your public policy argument. But instead he adopts this axiom that we know that these people are a burden and we know that more of them will come if we don't stop them now, right? So I have like as you can see, I have a little bit of a problem with the construction of this argumentation. I say it's a slippery slope argument, it's an irrational argument, the rationality is tainted with fear, that's why it is not an argument and shouldn't be there. All right, so I would really like to discuss these things with you, so let me try to conclude. And let me just say that the studying legal change is not without problems, and I was just going through my paper where I list all the caveats, and I was wondering how many of those I should mention, but let me mention a few. Have doubts. So jurisprudential shift is an elusive concept. Right, we all know that. It is observer dependent. What is changed to me is not changed to somebody else. Recall my anecdote. It is not linear, right? Sometimes change comes in big bouts. Otherwise, it does nothing happens for a very long time, then something happens. We don't know why. It is intermittent. It is not stable, right? A lot of times the changes don't stick. It's just like aberrations, right? And then the court comes back to its old case law, and sometimes individual judgments trigger effects, like effects which are sizable effects, right, for individuals, for policymakers, and otherwise, sometimes this change just goes completely unnoticed. And most of all, sometimes change is explicit, but most often is implicit, and it's inbuilt in what we call legal development, right? So how to conceptually separate something that we call the court develops the law, the court interprets the law, as to something that we can say the court changes the law. The idea is, like, it's a broader, it's a deeper problem, I think, in law, that there are never any fixed reference points, right? And this is the idea of law as being interpretive through and through, as Dworkin puts it, right? Law is interpretive through and through. We never have any fixed reference points. However, I still maintain that if we should problematize these concepts, we should study these concepts, we need to understand these concepts in order to understand judicial lawmaking. In mathematics, they talk about these seven unsolved mathematical world problems, whatever, and I think we should include legal change in one of the five unsolved of the legal scholarship problems. And my best bet, my best idea is to study the mechanisms that sustained change that the court uses, right? So rather than focus on only on the substance of cases, analyze cases, we should maybe focus on the layers of cases, so the layers of interpretation, layers of argumentation, and then the layers of outcomes, right? That sometimes change produces outcomes or not, and changes of reference frames. And I think that is the interplay between those layers where we can best detect and study change systematically, and where lawyers can have an advantage in saying something about legal change. Thank you.